In Christianity, there are certain core doctrines that are so critical to what it means to be Christian that if you denied them, you're literally denying the faith. And what we're going to do today is consider the doctrine that might be the most critical of them all. But I want to begin with a story that maybe you heard of the man who was at a funeral with his wife. Sadly, they were at the part of the service where they were at the grave site. The pallbearers are carrying the casket down the path. There was a little bend in the path, and there was a rock in that bend. One of the pallbearers tripped over the rock, fell. The casket fell down, opened up, and her body rolled out of the casket, and believe it or not, the woman revived. In fact, she lived with her husband for 3 more years, and then she passed away. And now they're having another service. Those same pallbearers are coming down that same path. They were at that same bend in the path, and all of a sudden the husband yells out, "Watch out for that rock!" Well, he must not have been a Christian, because to be Christian is to be excited about the prospect of resurrection. We eagerly anticipate the bodily resurrection from the grave as an expectation in the future that is grounded in the demonstration of God's power in the resurrection of Jesus Christ in the past. It is a demonstration that nails down for you and for me the chief claim of the Christian faith that Jesus Christ is indeed the Son of God. He is the way to God. We believe Jesus is the Word of God. Today we are declaring Easter is the proof of God. So Romans chapter 1 verse 4, look at this verse with me. It says this: "The Spirit of holiness was appointed the Son of God in power by his resurrection from the dead." Jesus Christ, our Lord. Christianity rises or it falls on this claim that when they crucified this young rabbi from Nazareth, they were putting a transient in the tomb. And friends and foes of Christianity recognize this is the one claim that makes or breaks all of the other claims. Even secular students of Christianity realize the significance of the doctrine of the resurrection. Years back, it was Newsweek magazine that had an article and a cover story on the unique doctrine of resurrection in the Christian faith. And the writer of the article said this, I quote, "By any measure, the resurrection of Jesus is the most radical of Christian doctrines. His teachings, his compassion for others, even his martyr's death, all find parallels in other stories and religious traditions. But of no other historical figure has the claim been made more persistently that God has raised him from the dead." The difference between Christianity and other world religions is you can't go to the tomb of the founder of Christianity where his body is in the ground and worship him. Friends, I've been there. It's still empty. That is the tomb where Jesus isn't. That's what's unique about Christianity. Several years ago, Tiger Woods won the Masters golf tournament for the second time, and he was asked what he would say to Bobby Jones if he was alive. Now, Bobby Jones was a great golfer. He was literally the Tiger Woods of his generation. He designed the Augusta National Golf Course. He died in 1971. That's even before Tiger Woods was born. So Tiger was asked, what would you say if Bobby Jones walked into the room right now? And Tiger said, well, first question I'd ask is, how'd you come back? If I go out, all I want to know is, how do I come back? There is out there a group that claims they are Christians, but they say, you know, it's not really important whether or not Jesus actually raised from the dead. What's important is that you believe in this principle of Easter that bad things might get better. Nope. Christianity without the resurrection of Jesus is not just missing the last chapter. It's missing the entire story. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15 verse 14, and if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. So write this down. If the tomb is not empty, then Christianity is. It's that simple. To be Christian is fundamentally to declare that Jesus Christ is risen from the dead. And that's why the critics of Christianity from the very beginning have tried to attack this claim. They've tried to discredit the story of the resurrection. Now, on this much, all of us agree, whether we are Christian or not, whether you are a friend or a foe of Christianity, we all agree on three things. We agree that Jesus of Nazareth, this amazing rabbi, was indeed crucified by the Romans. We all agree that the Jews took great effort and precaution to seal up the tomb. They literally put a seal on the tomb. They put guards at the tomb. And we all agree on this. His body is missing. Now, what happened? I believe to be a Christian is to live by faith, not by sight. I don't believe that means I've got to turn my brain off. I don't believe faith means I've got to stop using my head and just walk by my heart now. What we're going to do this morning is we're going to actually examine the evidence and ask ourselves, what is the most credible and best explanation for what happened to the body of Jesus? So I'm asking three different questions this morning, and here is the first one that we're going to ask. What best explains the gospel record? There's four accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And they appear very early on the scene, and every single one of them said, Jesus Christ is risen from the dead. Now, critics are going to claim that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are just fabricating this story designed to support this myth of the resurrection of Jesus. If that's true, then let's ask some really hard questions. Number one, why don't they include any eyewitness description of the resurrection? If I was going to write a lie about the resurrection of Jesus, I would have somebody that was actually there that actually saw this happen. Do you realize there is not one eyewitness description of the actual resurrection? And why did they portray the disciples as kind of dull and even hostile to the idea of resurrection? I would have written the story as if they were expecting it to happen. And why did they not paint the enemies of Christ monolithically? Instead, you've got this Sanhedrin, you've got this character in the Sanhedrin named Joseph of Arimathea, who is sympathetic to Jesus, who's named so that you can go and verify by his descendants what it is that really happened. And why on earth did they let women be the first witnesses of the resurrected Christ? Because back in that day, the testimony of women was worthless. It wasn't even allowed in court. So if you're going to start a legend, then at least have some guys be the first ones to see the resurrected Jesus. And why did they write the story that way? If I was going to write a legend, they made some really dumb choices. Or is it that they wrote it that way because that is actually how it happened? And remember this, they set the entire drama in the city of Jerusalem, not in Alexandria, not in Africa, not out in France somewhere, but in Jerusalem, the hardest place on earth to spread lies because so many people were still alive when all of this happened. They were still around that we could go and check out the facts with. So what best explains the gospel records? Here's another question. What best explains the missing body? That's a problem really for the skeptic, not for the believer. Now, some have tried to say, well, maybe the body isn't actually missing. Maybe the women just went to the wrong tomb. Like Joseph of Arimathea did not know where his own tomb was. Or maybe they all were hallucinating. Which, if you've had any work in the field of psychology, you know that's a preposterous claim. People who are not expecting something don't hallucinate that it is about to happen. Hallucinations don't last for 40 days and then just stop. 500 people don't have the same hallucination at the same time. I mean, if I walked up to you and I said, "How'd you like my dream last night?" You'd think I was crazy. And the biggest problem with all of those theories is simply this. If the women went to the wrong tomb, if it was just a bunch of hallucinating Jews, then the Jews that murdered Christ go to the right tomb, they roll back that stone, they grab the body and say, "Here's your dead Messiah." And Christianity dies. There is not an ancient or secular writer who argues the body is actually still in the tomb. They all admit from the very beginning that the body of Jesus is missing. So what happened to his body? There are three lines of thought or theory that are put forth by the skeptics on this. One is that the Jews and the enemies of Christ stole his body. Of course, the question is why? Why would they do that? What would be their motive? Why would they help start the very thing they were trying to stop? If they had the body, they could have produced the body and ended Christianity. Remember again, Christianity was birthed in Jerusalem, the hardest city on earth where it would have been to start something new like this. And all the critics did was just simply threaten the disciples, "You need to stop preaching that this man has been risen from the dead. We're going to put you in jail and we're going to beat you if you don't." Because that's all they could do. The enemies did not take the body of Jesus. The most popular theory is, well, the Christians, they're the ones. The disciples of Jesus stole his body. They stole his body and then they started preaching that Jesus is risen from the dead. Well, that's been around actually from the very beginning. Matthew chapter 28, read this with me in your own Bible. This is what it says. Verse 11, while the women were on their way, some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. When the chief priest had met with the elders and devised the plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, "You are to say, his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. If this report gets to the governor," that's Pontius Pilate, "we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed, and this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. But this story has some problems. First, guards in those days had a very great incentive not to fall asleep. It was called death. If you fell asleep, you died. Why did they have to actually be bribed if what happened was really true? What court of law, by the way, accepts testimony from people that were asleep? I mean, when have you ever heard a lawyer say in the middle of a trial, "Could you please recount for us what happened while you were sleeping?" Now, how did these disciples, if this is the way it went, how did these disciples sneak past these guards who were literally right in front of the tomb, take a almost one-ton stone, roll it away without making noise, take the body of Jesus without making noise, and get past the guards again and get away. And nobody woke up. But here's the biggest problem, actually. What's in it for the disciples? What's the gain? You say, well, they could preach that Jesus was risen from the dead and there's no body to prove them wrong. Well, what did they get out of it? Did they get fame? Did they get riches? Did they get notoriety? What they got was they got kicked out of the synagogues. They got fired from their jobs. They got run out of their homes. They got thrown into prison. They got tortured. They got murdered. Now you have to understand something very important. People will die for a lie if they believe that it is true. But people do not die for a lie when they know it's not true. You've heard the name of Charles Colson. Chuck Colson was a very important figure in the Nixon administration. He was one of the men involved in the famous Watergate scandal. He went to prison for that, and in prison he found Jesus. He became a very powerful evangelist in his day. He's passed on now. He's with the Lord now. But he was asked one time what lessons he learned from the Watergate story, and he said, you know what? I learned to believe in the story of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And here's how he explained that. He said, there were only 10 of us who knew the truth. Myself, Ehrlichman, Hodelman, John Mitchell, a handful of others. We were absolutely devoted to Richard Nixon. We had just helped him win a landslide election. The ugly Asian war was over. We were on the crest of a wave. You cannot imagine the power that we had. We managed billions of dollars. We could pick up a phone and armies, generals of armies and the Navy, they would jump to attention. We had private planes that would fly us all over the world, wherever we wanted to go. We had red jacketed servants that would cater to our every need. We could pick up the phone and call the National Gallery and have a priceless piece of art hung over our desk at a whim. And yet, when we started to get some pressure to cover up this lie, just 10 of us, we could not do it. And there wasn't a threat of execution. There was the threat of embarrassment, maybe a small jail sentence. And every single one of us cracked because the human instinct for self-preservation is that strong. People will die for a lie if they believe that it is true, but liars make terrible martyrs. And the early Christians did not go all over the world, get tortured, get crucified, get burned in oil, have their skin ripped off for a lie that they knew was a lie, and none of them cracked. The disciples did not steal the body of Jesus. One other theory about the body of Jesus actually came much later, about the 18th century. It's called the swoon theory. If you never heard of this, it argues that Jesus had a resuscitation, not a resurrection. In other words, he didn't really actually die on the cross. What happened is he kind of went into a coma, and then he came to while he was in the tomb. And the disciples just believed that it was a resurrection. So here's what that theory is asking you and I to actually believe. I'm supposed to believe that the Romans flogged Jesus, and we all know what that means. And they crucified Jesus. They put a spear in his side to actually make sure he was dead. They took him down, wrapped him in grave clothes, put him in a damp tomb with no food or water for 3 whole days, and somehow he comes to. He gets those clothes off. He, by himself, rolls back a stone from the tomb, from the inside, mind you, fights off the guards, beats them up, walks for miles, presents himself to his disciples and says, I have raised from the dead. Don't you want a body like mine? It takes more faith to believe that than it does to believe in the resurrection of Jesus. Forgetting the fact that the Romans themselves were experts in how to kill people and how to know what death actually looked like. See, my point is this: over 20 centuries later, skeptics have failed to put forth a credible explanation for the missing body of Jesus. All they do is they shake their finger and they say, well, he could not have raised from the dead, because that doesn't happen. It's never happened before and it's never happened after. Therefore, it couldn't have happened to Jesus. And we're going to get to that in a second. But I want to look at one more question with you, and that is this: what best explains historical Christianity? How do you even explain historical Christianity becoming a world religion? You go all the way back to AD 35, and if you were a betting man, which one would you put your money on? Who's going to survive? The global Roman Empire or this new Jewish cult called Christianity? How do you explain this little religion getting catapulted all across the earth by men and women who were ready to die for what they believed? Again, remember, where did it start? The hardest place on earth for it to start if it wasn't true. It's there that the very first sermon in Jerusalem is preached by Peter. Acts chapter 2, verse 24, he says, but God raised him from the dead, freeing him from the agony of death, because it was impossible for death to keep its hold on him. You go one chapter later in the book of Acts, and Peter says, you killed the author of life, but God raised him from the dead. We are witnesses of this. Paul preached the exact same way over in Acts chapter 13. Read it in your own Bible. Paul said this: fellow children of Abraham, and you God-fearing Gentiles, it is to us that this message of salvation has been sent. The people of Jerusalem and their rulers did not recognize Jesus, yet in condemning him, they fulfilled the words of the prophets that are read every Sabbath. Though they found no proper ground for a death sentence, they asked Pilate to have him executed. And when they had carried out all that was written about him, they took him down from the cross, laid him in a tomb, but God raised him from the dead. And for many days he was seen by those who had traveled with him from Galilee to Jerusalem. They are now witnesses to our people. You understand, they actually name these witnesses in their writings. They say, he saw him. He saw him. She saw him. They were still alive when they were doing this. That's because they were literally challenging the readers. Go check it out. Look at this. Look it up. Verify. We are telling you the truth. Why did they start meeting on the first day of the week? Why was that special? Why did they put such an emphasis on this ordinance called baptism, where you bury somebody underwater and then you raise them up and declare now they can live a new life? What about the critics, like the brother of Jesus, James, and this rabbi Saul that was murderously persecuting Christians? What happened to them to make them now become defenders of Christianity, willing to die for it? Why did they suffer persecution and murder gladly? Because they had witnessed a miracle. And at some point, it ceases to be a historical issue, and it becomes this philosophical issue about whether or not miracles are actually even possible. People say it didn't happen because it can't happen. Well, guess what? I agree. I contend there is no way naturally that Jesus was raised from the dead. But we are declaring that the resurrection of Jesus was not a natural event. It was a supernatural event. And it is indeed the best explanation based on the evidence. It simply requires this hypothesis: God exists. Now, that means taking a leap of faith. But that does not mean you have to be devoid of reason. You don't have to turn your brain off to become a Christian. The evidence is compelling. If you haven't read, you should read the book by Lee Strobel, The Case for Christ. And in that book, he gives, for example, the testimony of Sir Lionel Luckhoo, who was called by Guinness the world's greatest attorney, 245 straight murder acquittals. And in his own spiritual journey, this man who was knighted twice by Queen Elizabeth studied the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And this is what he concluded. He said, "I say unequivocally that the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ is so overwhelming, it compels acceptance by proof, which leaves absolutely no room for doubt." In the same book, he tells about being a moderator at a debate between William Craig Lane, a Christian apologist, and a speaker chosen by the American Atheist Society. Happened in 1993. 8,000 people were in attendance. Over 100 radio stations carried this debate live. He said, "It was so amazing," as Lee Strobel said this, "as I stood on the stage, I literally could see the faces of people change as William Craig Lane laid out for them the evidence of the resurrection. 82% of the people that were there that night said that the Christian case was the most convincing. And the amazing thing that night was, of that 8,000 people that attended, 47 people came to that building as an atheist, and they left as a believer in God's Son, Jesus. But not one person that night converted to atheism." And then there is this amazing story of a man that was named Dr. Anthony Flew, F-L-E-W. For many years, this brilliant English scholar was the atheist's greatest champion. He held debates all over the world. But back in 2004, he kind of shocked the world. He released a book entitled, "An Atheist Turns to Theism." And in that book, he argued, quote, "I had to go where the evidence led me, and the evidence leads me to believe there must be some grand creator or designer that explains our existence on earth." Now, he's not claiming that he's a Christian. He's simply arguing that the evidence is too overwhelming and compelling to believe anymore, that everybody and everything is just an accident. Now, over the years, he became friends with a man named Dr. Gary Habermas, who actually teaches at Liberty University, and they became good friends. They actually had several debates on the possibility of resurrection, and Dr. Habermas, who became a friend of Dr. Flew, said, "Now that you have become a believer in a greater power, can you concede that the resurrection is at least a possibility?" And he said, "I must concede that." And he asked Dr. Flew, "Then what about the resurrection of Jesus in particular?" And this man, who up until 2004 was atheism's greatest champion, said this. Look at it with me. "The evidence for the resurrection is better than for claimed miracles in any other religion. Is the real problem in accepting the resurrection of Christ a lack of evidence? Or is it a lack of will to bow to the implications of the evidence? I think it is the latter." The German theologian Hindenburg has it right when he says the evidence for Jesus' resurrection is so strong that nobody would question it except for two things. First, it's a very unusual event. And second, if you believe that it happened, it has to change the way you live. There's the problem right there. Most doubt is not intellectual. It is moral. I don't want to surrender to anybody. But friends, you have to realize this. If the tomb has surrendered to Christ, then I must. The problem is not really our head. The problem really is our heart. I believe Jesus is the Son of God. I believe he is the way to be right with God. I believe by his grace you are saved, and by his blood you are cleansed. I believe every single page of our Bible points us to him. And I tell you this because I'm bringing you to a point of decision. It is time that some of you need to get off the fence and you need to decide. Are you going to acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord or not? And I'm talking to some people who've actually been going to church for a long time in their life, but you've still sat on the fence. And the problem is not the evidence. The problem is the implication of the evidence. I remember when I was a boy, I studied the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in Pompeii, the city that was covered in that eruption. I found it compelling, just even as a child, when I looked at this. And over the years, there have been a lot of historical digs, and archaeologists have uncovered all kinds of interesting artifacts outside of Pompeii. But one of the most interesting artifacts that they did uncover was this gold and silver statue of the god Mercury that was held in the hand of a woman who was buried in lava. And the irony was, of course, Mercury to the Romans was the god of safety. It's not that she didn't have faith. She had faith in a god who was not worthy of her faith. And today I declare to you that Jesus Christ is worthy of your faith. He's worthy of our adoration. He's worthy of being declared Lord of every part of my life. And I've decided that I'm going to worship him with all of my head and with all of my heart. I'm betting my life on this side of the grave, and I am trusting my life on the other side of the grave, that Jesus Christ is the risen Son of God. And it's time that you make a decision about that in your own life. So what we're going to do is we're going to sing a song. And I'm calling every single person in this room that maybe you've never confessed Jesus. Go ahead and stand up. Maybe you've never been buried and raised with Jesus. I'm calling you to get off the fence today. But we're going to sing this song, and we're going to declare what we believe is true, the truth that changes everything. Up from the grave, he arose.